Chapter 6. Ultio. Lies and murder. The death of kings and queens. The officio presented the ship to them without ceremony. Like those it served, the vessel had a fluid identity. At the present moment, as it made its way towards the orbit of Jupiter, its pennants and beacons declared it to be the Halis Fae, an oxygen tanker out of series, registered to a Belta Coalition habitat. Its code name, revealed to Kel and the others as they boarded, was Ultio. Outwardly, the Ultio resembled the class of light bulk transport ships that travelled 1,000 different sublight intrasystem space lanes across the Imperium. It was a design so commonplace that it became almost invisible in its ubiquity, a perfect blind for a craft in service to the Officio Assassinorum. Small by the standards of the mammoth star cruisers that comprised the fleets of the Imperial Navy and the rogue trader Baronage, the Ultio was every inch a lie. A stubby trident, the shaft of the main hull, what appeared to be space for cargo, was in fact filled with the mechanisms and powertrain for an advanced design of interstellar warp motor. The craft had been constructed around the old engine, the origins of which were lost to time, and it was only the forward arrowhead-shaped section of the ship that was actually given over to cabins and compartments. This module, swept back and curved like an aerodyne, was capable of detaching itself from the massive drives to make planetfall like a gun cutter. Inside, the crew sections of the Ultio were cramped and narrow, with sleeping quarters no larger than prison cells, hexagonal corridors and a flight deck configured with advanced gravity simulators so that every square centimetre of surface area could be utilised. The ship had 3 permanent crew members, in addition to the growing numbers of the execution force, but none of them were what could be considered wholly human. As Kel walked towards the stern, he was aware that beneath his feet the ship's astropath lay sleeping inside a null chamber, having deliberately shocked itself into a somnambulant state. Similarly, the Ultio's navigator, who habitually remained far back among the systemry of the drive section, had also opted to drop into sense-depth slumber inside a similar contrapsychic chamber. Both of them had expressed grave displeasure at Iota's arrival on board, but their requests that she be sequestered or drugged into stasis were denied. Kel could only guess at how the delicate psionic senses of the warp navigator and the astrotelepath would be perturbed by the ghostly negative aura cast by the Culexus. Even he, without a taint of the psyker about him, found it profoundly unsettling to be around the pariah girl for too long. She had agreed to wear her dampener talk for the duration, but even that device could not block the eerie air that followed Iota wherever she went. The third member of the Ultio's crew was the least human of them all. Kel could still see the strange look of mingled horror and fascination on Tariel's face as they met the starship's pilot. There was no body to the pilot, not anymore. Like the venerable dreadnoughts of the Adeptus Astartes, a being that had once been a man many centuries ago was now only a few pieces of flesh interred inside a body of iron and steel. Somewhere, deep inside the block of computational hardware that filled the rear section of the crew deck, parts of a brain and preserved skeins of nerve ganglia were all that remained. Now he was the Ultio, and the Ultio was him. The hull his skin, the fires of the fusion core his beating heart. Kel tried to comprehend what it might be like to surrender oneself to the embrace of a machine. But he could not. He was on some base level appalled by the very idea of such a merging. But what he thought counted for nothing. The pilot, the navigator, the astropath, and all the rest of them, they were here to serve the interest of the Assassinorum, to do and not to question. He halted outside a hatchway, his boots ringing on the metal-grilled deck. "Ultio?" he asked the air. Is the Garantine awake?
Confirmed.
The pilot cyborg's voice came from a speaker grill above his head. It had the flat tonality of a synthetic vocoder.
Open it,
he ordered.
Complying, came the reply. Hazard warning. Increased gravity field ahead. Do not enter.
The hatch fell into the deck, and a waft of stale air, reeking of chemical sweat, wandered into the corridor. Inside, the Eversaur sat uncomfortably on the floor, his breathing labored. With visible effort, the Rage Killer lifted his head and glared at Kel.
When I get out of here,
he said, forcing the words from his mouth,
I am going to rip you apart.
Kel's lips thinned. He didn't approach any closer. Although the Garantine was not tethered to the deck by any chains or fetters, there was no way he could have come to his feet. The gravitational plates beneath the floor of the Eversaur's compartment were operating well above their standard setting, confining the assassin to the floor with the sheer weight of his own flesh. Veins stood out from his bare skin as his bio-modified physiology worked to keep him alive. An unaugmented human would have died from collapsed lungs or crushed organs within an hour or so. The Garantine had been in the room for 2 days now, enduring a regimen of antipsychotics and neural restoratives. Kel studied him.
It must be difficult for you, he began. The doubt, the uncertainty.
There's no hesitation in me,
gasped the Eversaur.
Let me up and you'll see.
The mission, I mean.
That got him the smallest flash of hesitation from behind the Garantine's skull face.
To wake without direction, that can't have been easy on you.
I will kill,
said the Eversaur. Yes, agreed the Vindicare. And kill and kill and kill, until you are destroyed.
But it will be for nothing. Worthless.
With an agonized grunt, the Garantine tried to lurch forward, clawing towards the open doorway.
I'll kill you,
he grated.
Worth something.
Kel resisted the reflex to step back.
You think so?
Broke your gun back there,
muttered the Eversaur, the sweat thick on his bare neck.
Pity. Were you attached to it?
Kel didn't rise to the bait. His prized long rifle had been custom-made by Isherite weaponsmiths, and it had served him well for years.
It was just a weapon.
Like me?
He spread his hands.
Like all of us.
Kel paused, then went on.
The accident that woke you early. The Vanus Tariel tells me that it would take too long to put you under again, to go through all the hypno-programming and conditioning. So we either vent you to space and start anew with another one of your kindred, or we find...
a different way.
The Rage Killer gave a coughing chuckle.
If I was chosen by my clade for whatever is planned, I'm the one you need. Can't do it without me.
I'm compelled to agree.
Kel gave a thin smile. The Garantine was no mindless thug. Appearances to the contrary.
I was going to say we would find an understanding.
The other assassin laughed painfully.
What can you offer me that would be richer than tearing your head from your neck, sniper?
The Vindicare stared into the Eversaur's wide, bloodshot eyes.
Nothing has been said yet, but the directors can only be bringing us together for one reason. One target. And I think you'd like to be there when he dies.
He said the name, and behind his fanged mask, the Garantine grinned. Yosef's hands were tight fists, and it was all he could do not to hold back and smack that weak half-smile off the face of Reeve Warden Lehmner. For a giddy moment he pictured himself with Lamna's greasy curls in his hand, smashing his face against the tiled floor of the precinct house, beating him into a broken ruin. The potency of the anger was startlingly strong, and it took an effort to rein himself in. Lamna was waving his hand in Daig's face and going on and on about how all of this was Segan's fault for not following proper channels, for not calling in backup units. He had been singing the same song all the way back from the Blasco Lodge.
"You lost the suspect," the warden bleated. "You had him and you lost him."
Lamna glared at Yosef.
"Why didn't you take a shot? Leg hit. Put him down, even."
"I could have walked Sig in through the front door," Daig grated. "He was going to surrender."
Lamna rounded on him.
"Are you an idiot? Do you really believe that?"
He stabbed at a pile of crime scene pics on the desk before him.
"Sig was playing you. He wanted to make meat toys out of you both, and you almost let him do it."
Yosef found his voice and bit out a question.
"How did you know where we were?"
"Don't be stupid, Sabrat," said the warden. "Do you think the High Reeve would let you off on a major case like this without having you tracked every second?"
Yosef saw Daig go pale at that, but he didn't remark on it. Instead, he pressed on.
"We had a solid lead from a reliable source. We could have brought Sig to book, but you came in mob-handed and ruined it." "Watch your tone, Reeve,"
Lamna shot back. He ran a deliberate finger down his warrant rod to emphasize his rank.
"Remember who you're talking to." "If you want to run this case, then do it," Yosef continued. "But otherwise, don't second-guess the investigating officers."
The warden's sneering smile returned.
"I was following Telemach's orders."
Yosef's lip curled.
"Well, thanks for making that clear. I thought it was just your impatience and poor judgment that would make this case fall apart. But it seems like the problem is further up the line."
"You insubordinate...
Sir..."
Skelter burst into the wardroom before Lamna could finish his sentence.
"He's here. The man. The Baron's man."
Lamna's attitude transformed in the blink of an eye.
"What? But they're not supposed to be here until tomorrow morning."
Skelter gestured at the door.
"Yes. No."
Yosef turned to see two figures entering behind the Jaeger. The first was an ebon-skinned man who matched Sabrat for height but was broader across the chest, with the thick-set look of a scrum-ball player. He had ash-coloured hair that fell to his shoulders and an oblong data monocle that almost hid a faint scar over his right eye. At his side was a pale, thin woman with a bald head covered in intricate tattoos. Both of them wore the same green and silver livery Yosef had seen on Bella Gorosp, but the man's cuffs bore some kind of ornate flashing that had to be indicative of rank. The woman had a golden brooch, he noted, in the shape of an open eye. As he looked at her, she raised her head to meet his gaze, and he saw the unmistakable shape of an iron collar around her neck, like one that might be used to tether a dangerous animal. It seemed crude and out of place on her. The man surveyed the room. Something in his manner told Yosef he had heard every word of the argument that had preceded his entrance. The woman, it was hard to determine her age, he noted, continued to stare at him. Lamna recovered well and gave a shallow bow.
"Operatives, it's a pleasure to have you here on Aiesta Veracrux."
"My name is Hissos," said the man.
His voice was solemn. He indicated his companion.
This is my associate, Perig.
Daig was gawking at the woman.
"She's a psyker,"
he blurted.
"The eye, that's what it means."
He tapped his lapel in the same place where Perig's brooch was pinned. Yosef saw that the eye design was subtly repeated in among the woman's tattoos. His first reaction was denial. It was common knowledge, even on the most parochial of worlds, that psykers were forbidden. The Emperor himself, at a council called on the planet Nykea, had outlawed the use of psionic sensitives, even among the legions of his own space marines. While some stripes of Psyker were approved under the tightest reins of Imperial control, the gifted navigators who guided ships through the Immaterium, or the telepaths who carried communications between worlds, for example, most were considered mind witches, dangerous and unstable aberrants to be corralled and neutered. Yosef had never been face to face with a Psyker before this day, and Perig unnerved him greatly. Her gaze upon him made him feel like he was made of glass. He swallowed hard, as at last she looked away.
My Lord Baron has sanction from the Council of Terror to employ an indentured psionic, Hissos explained. Perig's talents are extremely useful in my line of work.
And what work is that? Said Daeg. Security, Reeve Segan, he replied.
Hissos's manner made it clear he knew the name of every person in the room. Yosef nodded to himself. He knew that the Urotas clan wielded great power and influence across the Ultima Segmentum, but he had never guessed it had such reach. To be granted dispensation against so rigid a ruling as the Decree of Nykaea was telling indeed. He couldn't help but wonder what other rules the Void Baron was free to ignore.
I had expected you to go straight to the Urotas compound, Lamna ventured, trying to recover control of the conversation. You've had a long journey.
Not so long, replied Hissos,
still sweeping the room with his gaze.
The Baron will arrive very soon. He will want a full accounting of the situation. I see no reason to delay.
How soon?
Managed Skelter.
A day,
Hissos offered, his answer drawing Lamna up short.
Perhaps less.
The Reeve Warden licked his lips.
Well, in that case, I'll have a briefing prepared.
He gave a weak smile.
I will make myself available to the Baron on his arrival for a full and thorough...
Forgive me, Hissos broke in. Reeves, Sabrat, and Segan are the lead investigators in the case, are they not?
Well, yes, said Lamna,
clearly uncertain of how he should behave towards the Urotas operative.
But I am the senior precinct officer, and...
But not an investigating officer,
Hissos went on, his tone level and firm. He gave Yosef a brief glance through his monocle.
The Baron prefers to have information delivered to him as directly as possible, from the men closest to it.
Of course,
the warden said tightly, catching up to the realization that he was being dismissed.
You must proceed as you see fit.
Hissos nodded once.
You have my promise, Reeve Warden. Perig and I will help Aesta Veracrux to bring this murderer to justice in short order. Please pass that assurance on to the High Reeve and the Landgrave in my stead.
Of course,
Lamna repeated, his smile weak and false. Without another word, he left the room, shooting Yosef a final acid glare as he closed the door behind him. Yosef felt wrung out by the events of the day, even though it had hardly begun. He sighed and looked away, only to find the woman Perig watching him again. When she spoke, her voice had a melody to it that was at odds with the fire in her eyes.
There is a horror here, she told them. Darkness clustering at the edges of perception. Lies and murder.
The Psyker sighed.
All of you have seen it.
Yosef broke her gaze with no little effort on his part and gave Hissos a nod.
Where do you want to start?
You tell me, said the operative.
Ultio drifted into the gravity well of the gas giant, crossing the complex web of orbits described by Jupiter's outer moons. It was almost a solar system in miniature, with the gas giant at its core, rather than the blazing orb of a sun. The cloud of satellites and Trojan asteroids surrounding it were full of human colonies, factories and forges, powered by drinking in the radiation surging from the mammoth planet, feeding on mineral riches that in centuries of exploitation had yet to be fully exhausted. Jupiter was Terra's shipyard, and its sky was forever filled with vessels. centered around Ganymede and a dozen other smaller moons, space docks and fabricatories worked ceaselessly to construct everything from single-crew Raven interceptors up to the gargantuan hulls of mighty Emperor-class command carrier battleships. In a zone so dense with spacecraft and orbitals of every kind, it should have been easy for the Ultio to become lost in the shoals of them. But security was tight, and suspicion was at every point of the compass. In the opening moves of the insurrection, an alliance of turncoats, men of the Mechanicum and traitors from the Wordbearer's Legion, had assembled in secret a dreadnought called the Furious Abyss, constructing it in a clandestine berth on the asteroid moon Thule. The small Jovian satellite had been obliterated during the ship's explosive departure, and the ragged clump of its remains still orbited far out at the edges of the planetary system. But the shockwave from Thule's destruction and the Abyss incident was still being felt. Thus, the Ultio moved with care and raised no uncertainties, doing nothing to draw attention to itself. Secure in its falsehood, the vessel passed under the shadow of the habitats of Iacast and Anike, and then deeper into the Galilean ranges, passing the geo-engineered ocean moon of Europa and Io's seething orange mass. It followed a slow and steady course in across the planet's bands of dirty orange, umber, and cream-grey clouds, down towards the great red spot. A vast spindle floated there, bathed in the crimson glow. Saros Station resembled a crystal chandelier, severed from its mountings and cast free into the void, turning and catching starlight. Unlike the majority of its industrial and colonial cohorts, Saros was a resort platform where the Jovian elite could find respite and diversion from the works of the shipyards and manufactories. It was said that only the Venus orbitals could surpass Saros Station for its luxury. Avenues of gold and silver, acres of Nulgi gardens and auditoriums, and the finest opera house outside the Imperial Palace. The station filled the view through the Ultio's canopy as the ship drifted closer.
"Why are we here?"
asked Iota, with an idle sullenness.
"Our next recruit," Tariel told her. "Coin, of the Glade Calidus."
At the rear of the flight deck, the Garantine bent his head to avoid slamming it against the ceiling. He made a rasping, spitting noise.
"What do we need one of them for?"
"Because the Master of Assassins demands it," Kel replied without turning.
The Vanus glanced up from the displays fanned out around his gauntlet.
"According to my information, there is an important cultural event taking place. A recital of the opus Oedipus Neo."
"The what?"
sniffed the Eversaw.
"A theatrical performance of dance, music and oratory,"
Tariel went on, oblivious to his derision.
"It is a social event of great note in the Jovian zone."
"Must have lost my invite,"
the Eversaw rumbled.
"And this coin is down there?"
Iota wandered to the viewport and pressed her hands to it, staring at Saros.
"How will we know a faceless Calidus among so many faces?"
Kel studied the abstract contact protocols he had been provided and frowned.
"We are to send flowers."
Gergera Rai wept like a child as Jocasta went to her death. His knuckles turned white as he held on to the balustrade around the edge of the roaming box the theatre had provided. Behind him, the machine sentries in his personal maniples stood motionless and uncomprehending, as their master's lips trembled in a breathy gasp. Rai leaned forward, almost as if he could will her not to take the steel noose and place it over her supple neck. A cry was filling his throat. He wanted to call to her, but he could not. The nobleman had seen the opera before, and while it had always held his attention, it had never touched him as much as it had this night. Every biannual performance of Oedipus Neo was a lavish, sumptuous affair, orbited by dozens of stately dinners, parties, and gatherings. But at the core, it was about the play. Everyone in the Jovian set shared the same fears about this year's act. At first, it had only been dreary naysayers who claimed it should not be put on because of the conflicts. But then, after the diva, Silipis Nmun, had perished in a tragic airlock accident, many more had felt the opera should not have continued, as a mark of respect to her. But if he was honest, Ray did not miss Nmun on stage. As Jocasta, she had played the part with gusto and power indeed, but after so many repetitions, her investment in the character had grown careworn and flat. But now this new queen, this new Jocasta, a woman from the Venusian halls, as he understood it, had taken the part and breathed new life into it. In the first act, she seemed to mimic Moon's style, but soon she blossomed into her own interpretation of the role, and with it, she eclipsed the late diva so completely that Rai had all but forgotten her predecessor as the opera rolled towards its conclusion. The new actress had also brought with her new direction, and the performance had been shifted from the usual modern dress style to a strangely timeless mode of costume, all in metallic colours and soft curves that Rai found quite alluring. And now, with the stage drenched in blood-coloured light and flickers of lightning from the red spots beyond the skylights, the character of Jocasta took her own life as the orchestra struck an ominous chord. Against reason, Rai hoped that the play might suddenly diverge from the story he knew so well, but it did not. As the actress's body melted away into the wings and the final scenes of the opera unfolded, he found he could not focus on the fate of poor, blinded Oedipus, the lead actor giving his all in a finale that brought the audience to its feet in a storm of applause. It was only as the floating viewing box returned to the high balcony with a silken thud that Rai regained a measure of composure, pulling himself back from a daze. She had truly moved him. It had almost been as if this new Jocasta were performing only to Rai. He could swear that even in the moment of her drama's suicide, she had looked directly to him and wept in unison. Rai's ranking meant that he had, as a matter of course, an invitation to the post-show gathering in the auditorium proper. Usually he declined, preferring the company of his machines to those of the venal peacocks who drifted about Jupiter's entertainment community. Tonight, however, he would not decline. He would meet her. The party was jubilant, high with the thrill of the performance's energy, as if it still resonated around the theatre even after the last note of music had faded. Critics from the media took turns to congratulate the director and the actor who had played the tortured king. But all of them did so while looking about in hopes of catching a glimpse of the true star of the show, the queen of this night, the new Jocasta. Under the aegis of this, the invited nobles alternated between praising the opera and discussing the matters of the moment, and the latter meant discussion of the rebellion and of the pressures upon Jupiter and her shipyards. The wounds opened by the incident at Thule had not been healed, despite assurances from the Council of Terror, despite the quiet purges and the laying of blame. But accusations still crossed back and forth, some decrying the War Master for such perfidy and base criminality, others, those who spoke in hushed tones, wondering if the Emperor had let this thing occur just so he might tighten his grip on the Jovians. Every heartbeat of their forges was now turned to the construction of military machine designed to break the turncoat advance. But many felt it was bleeding Jupiter white. Those who questioned this questioned other things as well. They asked exactly how it was that a force of Mechanicum adepts and Astartes with traitorous intentions had been able to build a warship of the scope of the Furious Abyss, without alerting anyone to their duplicity. Was it possible that Jupiter harbored rebel sympathizers? It had happened with the Mechanicum of Mars. And so, some whispered, even among the warlords of Earth's supposedly united nation-states. The questions turned and turned, but they faded when Gurgara Rai entered the room. Resplendent in the circuit-laced robes of a mech lord, Rai's high status as master of Capacan sect of the Legio Cybernetica was known to all. Two full cohorts of combat mechanoids were under his personal command, and they had fought in many battles of note during the Great Crusade, alongside the Lunar Wolves and the War Master. Like many of the Cybernetica, Rai eschewed the gross cyborg augmentations of his colleagues in the Mechanicum in favor of subtle enhancements that did not disfigure or dilute his outwardly human aspect. But those who knew Rai knew that whatever humanity he did show was rare and fleeting. Behind him, moving with fluidity, his bodyguards were a three-unit maniple of modified Crusader-class robots. Painted as works of art, each insect-like machine was a stripped-down variant of its battlefield standard, armed with a discreetly sheathed power rapier and lasgun. A fourth mechanical, this one custom-built to resemble a female form rendered in polished chrome, walked at his side and served as his aide. No one asked questions about loyalty when Rai was nearby. His machines could hear a whisper among a roaring crowd, and those who dared to suggest aloud that Rai was anything less than the Emperor's obedient servant lived to regret it. The mech lord took a schooner of an indifferent vegan brandy and pecked at a few small sweetmeats from ornamental serving trays offered by menials, allowing his mechanoid aide to delicately sniff at each before he ingested it. The robot's head was filled with sensing gear, capable of picking up any particulate trace of poison. The machine shook its head each time, and so he ate and drank. But none of the rich foodstuffs sated the real hunger in him. Rai engaged in a moment or two of small talk with the director of the opera house, but it was a perfunctory and hollow exchange. Neither of them wanted to spend time with one another. Rai was simply uninterested, and the director was doubtless racked with worry over the reason why the Capacan general had decided to take up his long-ignored invite. But both of them had to fake the genial nothings of greeting for the sake of propriety.
"My Lord Rai."
He turned as a servant approached, a young man in the Saros livery with a wary cast to his face. He nervously sidestepped the Crusaders and offered a card to the mech lord. And that was his error. The servant did not wait to be addressed, but instead proffered the card before it was acknowledged. Rai's aide stepped in to meet him with a faint hiss of hydraulics, and in one fluid motion took the hand holding the card and broke it at the wrist. The bone cracked wetly, and the servant went white with shock, staggering. He would likely have fallen if the machine had not been holding him up.
"What is this?" he asked.
The servant spoke through gritted teeth.
A message for you, sir,"
he gasped, and gave him a pleading look.
"Please, I only did as the lady asked me to."
"The lady?"
Rai's heart thumped in his chest.
"Give it to me."
His aide took the card and held it to her chromium lips. She licked it with a disconcertingly human-looking tongue, paused, then handed it on to her master. Had there been any contact toxins on the surface, she would have destroyed it. The mech lord fought off a tremor in his hands as he read the languid flowing script written across the white card. It was a single word. Come. He turned it over and saw it listed a location in the apartments reserved for the opera house's performers.
"Is something amiss?"
said the director, his face pinched in concern. Rai pressed his half-empty brandy glass into the man's hand and walked away. His robots followed, and behind them, the servant staggered down to his knees. clutching at his ruined wrist. The apartments were a short new car ride up three levels to Saros Station's most exclusive residential decks. Rye had his own orbital out by Callisto and did not keep rooms here, but he had visited the chambers in the past during one of his many affairs, and so he knew where to go. The presence of his maniple made sure that no one dared to waylay him, and presently he reached the room. His aide knocked on the door, and it opened on silent servos. From within came that silken voice.
"Come,"
she said. Rye took a step, and then hesitated. His pulse was racing like that of a giddy youth in the first blush of infatuation, and, he had to admit, as much as he was enjoying the sensation of it, he was still the man he was, still distrustful of everything on some deep level. His enemies had tried to use women as weapons against him before, and he had buried them. Could this be one more attempt to do the same? His throat went dry. He hoped it would not be so. The strange, ephemeral connection he felt with the actress seemed so very real, and the thought that it might be a thing brought into existence just to hurt him cut deeply. For a long moment he wavered on the threshold, contemplating turning about and leaving, taking the new car back to the docks and his yacht, leaving and never coming back. Just making the thought felt like razors in his gut. And then she spoke again.
"My lord?"
He heard the mirror of his own questions and fears in her words. His aide walked in ahead of him, and Rye went to follow, but again he hesitated. Even if what he hoped for would come about in this glorious evening, he could not afford to lose sight of the realities of his life. He turned to the Crusaders and spoke a string of command words. The robots immediately took up sentry positions around the door to the apartment, weapons ready, bowing their mantis-like heads low so that they would not damage the lamps hanging from the ceiling above. Rye entered the room and became overcome by a vision. His first thought was, "She's not dead." But of course that was true. It had only been a play, and yet it had seemed so real to him. The woman stood, still dressed in her queenly costume, the sweep of her lithe and flawless skin visible through the diaphanous silver of the dress. Metallic glitter accented her cheekbones and the almond curves of her dark eyes. She bowed to him and looked away shyly.
"My Lord Rye, I feared you would not visit me. I feared I might have presumed too much."
"Oh, no," Rye said, dry-throated. "No, it is my honour."
He managed a smile.
"My queen."
She looked up at him, smiling too, and it was magnificent.
"Will you call me that, my lord? May I be your Jocasta?"
She toyed with a thin drape of silk that curtained off one section of the apartments from another. He was drawn to her, crossing the white pile of the anteroom's rich carpeting.
"I would like that very much," he husked.
The woman, his Jocasta, threw a look towards his mechanoid.
"And will she be joining us?"
The open invitation in her reply made Rye blink.
No.
He turned and spoke tersely to the robot.
"Wait here."
His Jocasta smiled again and vanished into the room beyond. Grinning, Rye paused and unbuttoned his tunic. Glancing around, he saw a spray of fresh saturnine roses still in their delivery wrappings. He tossed his jacket down next to them and then followed her into the bedchamber. Jocasta did not weep as Gurgara Rye went to his death. The queen enveloped him in long, firm arms as he stepped in, bringing her body up to meet his, pressing her breasts to his chest, moulding herself to him. The mech lord's dizzy smile was shaky, and he gasped for air. His reactions were perfect. his flawless new love for Jocasta, for that was what it was, the most pure and exact rendition of neurochemical release, was the final product of weeks of carefully tailored pheromone bombardment. Tiny amounts of metadopamine and serotonin analogues had been introduced to Rye over time. The dosages light enough that even the ultra-sensitive scanners of his machine aid would not detect them. The cumulative amounts had pushed him into something approaching obsession, and combined with a physiological template based on his taste in female bed partners, the trap had been set and laden with honey. Jocasta bent Rye's head down to meet hers and pressed her lips to his. He shuddered as she did it, surrendering to her. It was so easy. Gergera Rye had been involved in the creation of the Furious Abyss, not in a way that could be proven without doubt in a court of law, not in a way that connected him through any direct means, but enough that the guardians of the Imperium were certain of it. Whatever his crime, perhaps the transfer of certain bribes, the diversion of materials and manpower, the granting of passage to ships that should have been denied, the Capucan Mechlord had done the bidding of the traitor Horus Lupercal. The small weapon concealed between Jocasta's tongue and the base of her mouth was pushed up, held in place by clenched teeth. A lick of the trigger plate was all that was needed to fire the kiss gun. The needle-sized round penetrated the roof of Rye's mouth and fragmented, allowing the threads of molecule-thin wire to explode outward. The threads whirled through the meat of his nasal cavity and up into his forebrain, shredding everything they touched. He lurched backwards and fell to the bed, blood and brain matter drooling from his lips and nostrils. Rye sank into the silken sheets, his corpse dragging them awry, revealing beneath the body of the actress whose face he had loved so ardently. His killer moved quickly, shrugging off the illusion of the dead woman even as the target's corpse began to cool. Flesh shifted in small ways, the Jocasta face slipping to become less defined, more like a sketch upon paper. The killer spat out the kiss gun and discarded it, then drew sharp nails along the inside of a muscular thigh. A seam in the skin parted to allow a wet pocket to open, and long fingers drew out a spool and handle affair from within. The killer gently shook the device and padded towards the silk curtains. Rye had died silently, but the machine aid was clever enough to run a passive scan for heartbeats every few seconds, and if it detected one instead of two. The spool unwound into a thin taper of metal, which rolled out to the length of a meter. Once fully extended, the weapon became rigid. It was known as a memory sword, the alloy that comprised the blade, capable of softening and hardening at the touch of a control. Coin liked the memory sword, liked the gossamer weight of it. Coin liked what it could do as well. With a savage slash, the blade sliced down the thin silk curtain, and the motion alerted the mechanoid, but not quickly enough. Coin thrust the point into the aide's chromium chest and threw the armor casing around the biocortex module that served as the robot's brain. It gave a faint squeal and became a rigid statue. Leaving the sword in place, Coin took a moment to prepare for the next template. Coin knew Gergera Rye as well as the actress who played Queen Jocasta, and would adopt him just as easily. The Calidus despised the term mimicry. It was a poor word that could not encompass the wholeness with which a Calidus would become their disguises. To mimic something was to ape it, to pretend. Coin became the disguise. Coin inhabited each identity, even if it was for a short while. The Calidus was a sculpture that carved itself. Bioimplants and heavy doses of the shapeshifter drug, polymorphine, made skin, bone, and muscle become supple and motile. Those who could not control the freedom it gave would collapse and turn into monstrosities, things like molten waxworks that were little more than heaps of bone and organs. Those with the gift of the self, though, those like Coin, they could become anyone. Concentrating, Coin shifted to neutrality, a grey sexless form that was smooth and almost without features. The Calidus did not recall any birth gender. That data was irrelevant when it was possible to be man or woman, young or old, even human or Xenos if the will was there. It was then Coin saw the flowers. They had been delivered by courier shortly before Rai had arrived. The assassin picked at the plants and noted the colour and number of the petals on the roses. Something like irritation crossed the killer's no-face, and Coin paused at the Voxcom alcove in the far wall, inputting the correct sequence of encoding that the flower arrangement signified. The reply was almost immediate, meaning that there was a ship nearby.
Coin?
A male voice, gruff with it. The Calidus immediately copied the tonality and replied,
"You have broken my silent protocol. We are here to help you conclude your mission as quickly as possible. You have new orders. I have no idea who you fools are, or what authority you may think you have, but you are compromising my operation and getting in my way."
Coin grimaced. It was an ugly expression on the grey face.
"I don't require any help from you. Don't interrupt me again."
The Calidus cut the channel and turned away. Such behaviour was totally unprofessional. The Clade knew that once committed, an assassin's cover should not be compromised except in the direst of circumstances, and someone's impatience was certainly not reason enough. Coin sat and concentrated on Gurgur Arai, on his voice, his gait, the full sense of the man. Skin puckered and moved, thickening. Implants slowly expanded to add mass and dimension. Moment by moment, the killer changed. But the task was still incomplete when the three Crusaders crashed in through the doorway, searching for a target. Kell glared at the Vox pickup before him.
"Well, that was discourteous," he muttered.
"Arrogance is a noted character trait of many of the Clade Calidus," Iota offered.
The Garantine looked at Kell from across the Ultio's cramped bridge.
"What are we supposed to do? Take in a show? Have a little dinner?"
The hulking killer growled in irritation.
"Put me down at the station. I'll bring the slippery changer freak back here in pieces."
Before Kell could reply, a sensor telltale on one of the consoles began to blink. Tariel motioned at the hololiths around his gauntlet, and his expression grew grave.
"The ship reads energy weapon discharges close to Coin's location."
He looked up, out past the nose of the ship to where the hull of Saros Station drifted nearby.
"The Calidus may be in trouble."
"We should assist," said Iota.
"Coin didn't want any help," Kell replied. "Made that very clear."
Tariel gestured at his display.
"Orspec's magnoscan shows multiple mechanoid units in the area. War robots, Vindicare. If the Calidus becomes trapped..."
Kell held up a hand to silence him.
"The Master of Assassins chose this one for good reason. Let's consider this escape a test of skill, shall we? We'll see how good this Coin is."
The Garantine gave a rough snort of amusement. Coin made it into the enclosed avenue outside the apartments with only minor injuries. The Calidus had been able to recover the memory sword from the steel corpse of the aide, realizing far too late that there had to have been a fail-safe backup biocortex inside the machine, one that broadcast an alert to the rest of Rai's bodyguard maniple. Coin did not doubt that other robots were likely vectoring to this location from the Mechlord ship, operating on a kill switch protocol that activated with the death of their master. The core directive would be simple. Seek and destroy Gurgur Arai's murderer. If only there had been more time. If Coyne could have completed the change into Rye, then it would have been enough to fool the auto-sensors of the machines, long enough to reach the extraction point and exfiltrate. Rye and the actress would have been found days later, along with all the evidence that Coyne had prepared to set the scene for a murder-suicide shared by a pair of doomed lovers. It had a neatly theatrical tone that would have played well to Saros Station's intelligentsia. All that was wasted now, though. Coyne limped away, pain burning from a glancing laser burn in the leg. The Calidus looked like an unfinished model in pinkish-grey clay, caught halfway between the neutral self-template and the form of the Mech Lord. There was a cluster of revelers coming the other way, and Coyne made for them, fixing the nearest with a hard gaze and imagining their identity as the assassin's own. The Calidus heard the heavy stomp of the spindly Crusader robots as they scrambled in pursuit, chattering to one another in machine code. The small crowd reacted to the new arrival, the merriment of the group dipping for a moment in collective confusion. Coyne pressed every grain of mental control into adopting the face of the civilian, or at least something like it, and swung into the mass of the group. The robots stood firm and blocked the avenue, guns up, the faceted eyes of their sensor modules sweeping the crowd. The revelers lost some of their good humour as the threat inherent in the maniple of machines became clear. Coyne knew what would happen next. It was inevitable, but at least the hesitation would buy the assassin time. The Calidus searched for and found a side corridor that led towards an observation cupola and began pushing through the people towards it. This was the moment when the machines opened fire on the crowd. Unable to positively identify their target among the group of people, yet certain that their master's murderer was in that mass, the Crusaders made the logical choice. Kill them all and leave no doubt. Coyne ran through the screaming, panicking civilians, laser bolts ripping through the air, cutting them down. The assassin vaulted into the corridor and ran to the dead end of it. Red light from the giant Jovian storm seeped in through the observation window, making everything blurry and drenched in crimson. Time again. Little enough time. The Calidus concentrated and retched, opening a secondary stomach to vomit up a packet of white, doughy material. With shaking hands, Coyne ripped open the thin membrane sheathing it and allowed air to touch the pasty brick inside. It immediately began to blacken and melt, and quickly the assassin pressed it to the glassaic of the cupola. The robots were still coming. The shooting had stopped and the Crusaders were advancing down the corridor. Coyne saw the shadows of them jumping on the curved walls, lurching closer. The assassin sat down in the middle of the room and drew up into a fetal ball, forgetting the face of the civilian, forgetting Gergara Rye and the Queen Jocasta, remembering instead something old. Coyne let the polymorphine soften flesh into waxen slurry, let it flow and harden into something that resembled the chitin of an insect. Air was expunged, organs pressed together. By turns, the body became a mass of dark meat, but still not quickly enough. The Crusader maniple advanced into the observation cupola just as the package of thermoreactive plasma completed its oxygenation cycle and self-detonated. The blast shattered the glassaic dome, and everything inside the cupola was blown out into space. Rye's guardian machines spun away into the vacuum, even as safety hatches fell to seal off the corridor. Coyne's body, now enveloped in a cocoon of its own skin, went with them into the dark. Outside, the Ultio hove closer.